Hi there, I'm Rory O'Connor, Professor of Health Psychology and a Mental Health Researcher at the University of Glasgow.
And I'm Craig, a filmmaker and content creator at MQ Mental Health Research.
And welcome to MQ Open Mind, a podcast that brings together lived experience with scientific research to help us to better understand mental health problems. And we hope to do so in a way that is accessible to all.
In this episode, we speak to clinical psychologist and author, Dr. Marta Deros Callado. Dr. Marta is a highly experienced psychologist specializing in child and young people's mental health. During the COVID pandemic, Dr. Marta started sharing her expertise on Instagram, amassing a following of over 250,000 people. Recently, she released her first book, How to Be the Grown-Up, which aims to use research and science to help parents in the child-rearing process. In this conversation, we discuss potential improvements to CAMHS, the effects of social media, and how to gain a deeper insight into your child.
Welcome to the latest episode of MQ's Open Mind. Once again, Craig and I are delighted to welcome another fantastic guest. So today we've got Marta Deros Callado. And Marta is a clinical psychologist and works currently in private practice, but has 18 years of experience working in the NHS. And we'll be talking a lot about your interest in parenting and really exciting news. We'll come on to your book. First book, I think. It's your first book.
Oh, yes, definitely first.
It's coming out at the end of February, which my experience is that. So that month leading after seeing the book and then obviously waiting for it to come out into the real world is always a bit of an anxiety provoking, but exciting time. But anyway, welcome, Marta, and thanks for agreeing to take part in our podcast here today.
Thank you for having me. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, welcome in.
Well, meet you. Well, yeah. So my understanding is, apparently we've met before, which I was aware of when we did a bit of a chat beforehand.
We have met before, yeah, in Cambridge when I worked at Annabrooks Hospital. You did a seminar on suicide, and it was really helpful. And I remember coming up to say hi to you because I've worked with your brother at Leeds University, where I did my master's in health psychology.
Yeah, so this is always the bizarre small world that, for those who don't know, I have an identical twin brother who's also a psychologist. And I did that thing that when we met before this recording of saying, I don't think we've met, have we? And then you told me otherwise. Anyway, it's delightful to meet you again, Marta. And I will tell Daryl, my brother, that
that'd be nice.
That you're asking for him. So he's still at Leeds University and still obviously working away, and we obviously collaborate as well together. Nice. Anyway, enough about me and my twin brother. Marta, so tell us a bit about your interest in mental health. And so obviously, looking at your CV, you've got your clinical psychologist, you've done your master's in health psychology, and you've also been really interested in family systems type approaches as well. So can you tell us a bit about your sort of journey and sort of interest in mental health?
So I don't know if this is like a traditional route or not, probably not, but I have always been interested in health. And when I was little, if you'd asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up? I really don't like that question. But if you had asked me that question, I would have said medicine. And I wanted to work in pediatrics as a doctor. And then what happened was, before choosing universities, I found out you had to do surgery as part of your medical training. And I did not want to do that, like, at all. Like, it was a big fat no for me. And that kind of really disrupted my path a little bit, because I was suddenly stuck. I was like, well, now I don't know what I want to do. And I was just really lucky. I had a really wonderful English teacher. Amazing. This is why teachers are so key, I think, to children, by the way. I really think they can be such inspiring people. He said to me, but you speak and you think like a psychologist, because we used to have to do like book reviews. And I was like, what's a psychologist? I didn't even know what it was.
What age were you in this? What age was this?
I was about 16. Yeah, really young. And I was like, I don't know what a psychologist is. And he was like, but you are one. Like, you talk like one, you analyze text like one. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I looked into it, and at the time saw like forensic psychology, clinical psychology, you know, all these different facets, areas. And I was like, oh, actually, this is really interesting. Or maybe I would be interested in this. Mm-hmm. So I ended up doing an undergrad at York. And at the time, York was really high on research. I've always been really interested in research. So I went to York. and loved it. I was like, this is it. This is my calling. And then found out that there was such a thing as a health, you know, health psychology. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
But as an undergraduate though, did you do health psychology as part of the undergraduate course?
Yeah, they had an advanced module in health psychology, which I took, which I loved. And then I applied for a grant so I could do it. And Leeds was somewhere I could do it. So I applied and somehow just feel very privileged, very lucky I got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that and I loved it. And then by that point, while I was in the master's, I started to kind of think, where am I going with this?
Mm-hmm.
And I was really interested in clinical because it felt like a step further, you know? And I mean, it's just luck. Some of it's luck. Some of it's obviously me still focusing on health, I guess. But my assistant role was in pediatrics at the Evelina, which is the Children's Hospital of St. Thomas's in London.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I went after I did my master's and I fell in love with it. Like, absolutely. It was like, this is it. This is my element. This is my world. Mm-hmm. Applied for the course thinking there's no hope I'm going to get on. And I got on first time. So this is also to say to anybody listening to this podcast who wants to be in training, mm-hmm. it is possible. And no, you don't have to go through 3,000 hoops all the time. Because mm-hmm. I think there was a lot of fear at the time, like, don't apply. You're not going to get in. You need like 10 years experience. And mm-hmm. I just, you know, it's not necessarily true is what I think. I think it's also about how you talk about your experience and the things that you've learned. And I was very lucky because I had such great experience from undergrad, master's, you know, mm-hmm. work experience. And that's what got me here, I think. And then I qualified and I went straight into pediatrics and I didn't move. I moved around, but I always stayed in the same field. It's child mental health, parenting, family, mm-hmm. kind of cohesion, all that kind of stuff is the stuff I'm really interested in. It's the stuff I love.
No, great journey. And so just in terms of, you said you obviously really loved the research end of things. So going back to your doctorate then, so did you do research on sort of mental health aspects of pediatrics or?
So I did, yeah. Yeah, I looked at a group of children that used to run at St. Thomas's. I think it still does. They're called Evelina's Pride. Mm-hmm. And looked at, it was a qualitative study, which I'd never done and felt very out of my comfort zone. Like, give me numbers. I feel more comfortable. But then I loved it. Like, I loved doing the research. I loved finding out about how, you know, looking at the narratives, the stories. That's what got me into systemic. That's what got me into thinking about doing family therapy training. So, you know, all these little things that we do sometimes, small choices turn into like something else. So I did that qualitative study on that group, looking at whether you need a heterogeneous group or homogeneous group and mm-hmm. what the differences are, because all the kids have different chronic health conditions in the group. But, and yet it's one of the most supportive peer support kind of that they get from the group mm-hmm. is really impactful and powerful.
Sorry, with that, what do you mean by heterogeneous and homogeneous?
So heterogeneous means that it's mixed. So they're not all the same. So for example, a heterogeneous group might be children who are under cardiac treatment. So whether they've got heart surgery or they've got some kind of heart condition. Oh no, heterogeneous, that's homogeneous. I got myself confused. Heterogeneous means, so that's homogeneous, which means everyone has the same condition. You could also have a homogeneous group that would be all boys or all girls, for example, right? There's something that brings them all together. And heterogeneous means that there's a mix. So in this case, there were kids who had cardiology problems, neurology problems, urology problems, allergies, you know, cancer, all sorts. And they're all brought together in this kind of social peer support group. And I guess my research question was, what effect does that have when some of them are like, I have a life-threatening or life-shortening condition and somebody mm-hmm. else doesn't. But actually the outcome was, it's an incredibly supportive group and actually a lot more, in some ways, more motivating than some of the research that was done with other groups that are homogeneous, because it seemed to kind of celebrate people's strengths and skills better. And so rather than feeling like I'm stuck and somebody who is like me is also stuck, so we're both stuck together, it opened up possibilities. And it was just, it's a really kind of powerful thing to kind of see in a study that actually it's the difference that creates a positive difference, if that makes sense, or a benefit.
Great description. So actually, just on terminology then as well, so you mentioned family therapy as well.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about what that is, for those who don't understand or aren't familiar with that. And also just a bit of the journey. So you did your MSc, then you did your clinical.
Yeah.
And then did you then practice for a while and then do the family therapy course?
Did my family therapy course while I practiced. So as soon as I qualified for my doctorate in London, well, I went to the Tavistock, which is where I did my family therapy diploma, and they do it part-time. And so I asked my work if I would be allowed to train in this alongside work. So I think they had to release me like once a week to do the kind of formal studying. But then a lot of the studying is kind of with practice. So I was very, again, lucky, privileged, very supportive work within the NHS. I had to apply for it, but they said yes, because within that team at the time, the psychology team in pediatrics, they didn't have a family therapist. So to them, it was like a strength and a positive that we could then start running family therapy sessions, which is what we did, and kind of run those as a team. So me doing it because of my interest meant everybody benefited within the service, if that made sense.
Yeah, totally. So then in terms of what family therapy is, so for the uninitiated.
Yeah, so family therapy is a different speciality, and it thinks about systems and the way that they shape us and impact on us, and the way that we impact on systems ourselves as well. And systemic practice is more like a philosophy rather than a model. It's a way of seeing the world and thinking about people within it, and thinking about things like culture, society, gender, illness, so physical illness, any kind of factor around us. They have this thing called graces, I'm going to get them wrong, but which help you remember things like gender, religion, age, culture, community, I'm going to get it wrong, society, and I can't remember what E is.
Equality? No, I don't know.
Equality? No, I think it's ethnicity, actually.
Ah, there we go.
Ethnicity. But the kind of practice is about being aware of all these factors and how they influence people. And then there are different ways through conversation often, but also kind of there's different types of models. That some of them are a bit more like structural model, where you might move people in the room or move things around the room. But it's a way of giving people another perspective on their life. And a lot of systemic is about taking a non-expert position. So it's very different to a different model, like cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, where you have somebody who's an expert who guides you through action. Systemic practice is more about saying, I'm aware that as a professional, I also impact on you, but I'm going to try and bring that impact down by normalizing some of the things I say, by like punctuating where it's coming from. So for example, if I'm talking to a mother, I might say, as a mother myself, this is something I do with my child. Does that make sense?
Rather than
from an expert chair of what should be done. And it's something that I find really useful alongside lots of the models that I've learnt in my clinical psychology, like doctorate. So it's something that I feel like I bring along with rather than exclusively. So I do both and, if you like, particularly things around language and how we speak and the power that words can have and shape our understanding of each other and the problem. So I often think about language and how it shapes our perspective of things.
Yeah, and indeed, in terms of the evidence base, there's obviously evidence for different mental health conditions and for family systems-based approaches. And again, I suppose an illustration of the wide diversity of treatment options for mental health problems. So maybe then, if we think then about, as this is a research podcast, I'm going to get to your book in a second, because I have some questions around what your book covers and how that links to parenting and so on. But before we get there, can you tell us a bit, right? So you've a grounding in research, and you've said you have this passion for research. So if you had all the money in the world, like what would you think? And suppose in the field that you're really interested in, pediatrics, family systems, and so on, like what are the big research questions that you would like to address?
I mean, I've got two in my mind, but they're so different to each other. So I'll start with one that I've always had, or not had, but there isn't enough research on siblings. Like, there just simply is not. And in work, when you work with child mental health, you inevitably, if you work with one child, you work with the whole system. And by the system, I mean the whole family. You work with mum and dad and their siblings. And if you work in pediatrics in a health related field, like I have my whole career, it's very obvious that siblings get impacted by the fact that they have a brother or a sister who is unwell in some way, either because parents' focus of attention and time is taken from them, because of course they have physical needs to look after, and or for like anxiety about their sibling, worry about what's going to happen to them when they come to hospital, when they have an inpatient appointment, all those sorts of things. And it's really not very well understood the impact that it has on siblings, like siblings who are okay. There isn't really any good research looking at quality of life for these siblings that would help, I think, psychologists like me think about what are the services that are the, what's the service gap? Like, what are we missing in these children? And would it have to be somewhere like at school? Would it have to be that like other members of our society, again, if we think systemically, you know, who are the adults who can provide the support and care or meet the gap for these children? And I think often these children have other mental health issues and issues such as school refusal, such as anger, such as low mood, such as anxiety. And sometimes because the other adults in this child's world, whether it's a teacher or, I don't know, it could be a sports coach or something, only see this child as a well child, they're not really considering the impact that their sick sibling has. And I know from families I've worked with that not everybody shares that one of their children is really unwell. So unless you know that child, you might not know what the stresses are on the family. And for me, there is just a huge, like, empty space for sibling research that isn't looked into, I feel, very well. And we used to run sibling groups in our hospital to try and fill some kind of gap. But again, I feel like it was, we were muddling at how to set them up.
Yeah, because I was really curious on that, because I agree it's an important area. And I'm just thinking in my own family, one of my brothers has a, one of their children has a life-limiting illness, and you can see from far the impact, of course, on the siblings. And to my knowledge, there's no, the support that they've had hasn't been through a clinical service necessarily on the sibling, but through other charitable organizations, which I think there is such a gap. So just really curious then, and when you said that you set up sibling groups, so how would it, but how would you get invited into or referred into that service or support? Because
the way our model was, obviously the sibling would have been in one of our teams. So I had half a day in general pediatrics, half a day. I can't even explain how little that is. Amongst, obviously I worked full time, but half, you know, 3.5 hours of my week was dedicated to this. But that's a different conversation. What we did was across, particularly general pediatrics, where we saw children with in services that didn't have dedicated psychology, so they didn't have psychologists like me embedded within their medical team. If the parents felt that their siblings would benefit from having, basically, I think we called it social support, but also it was just like afternoon with snacks, basically. Then the parents could ask for it and fill in a form. And then we did like a short assessment on the phone that our assistant psychologists, who are such valued members of any NHS team, I feel they do so much work, would call and do an assessment, and then they would come to see us. Mm-hmm. And it was like in the evening, after school, so it didn't impact on their school. But to me, there were so many issues to this. It's in the evening, but it's in a hospital, but they're not sick kids.
Exactly.
But that's where we're based, right? So that's all we had to offer. Like, we had a room, so that's what we used. But, you know, to me, I was like, this isn't quite right. And we offered kind of very open conversations, so that open questions and some little games and some like kind of structured work that was about identifying their identity and their needs and the things that they really enjoy and the things that they struggle with, to have that kind of openness to kind of say, I'm struggling, if so. And if they did, then we would try and then meet with them and assess them and pass them on. I hate this, but like kind of pass them on to somebody else who would often be CAMHS, so Child Adolescent Mental Health Services. But it's not right. Like, I feel like this is not right. And you're 100% correct. The way that I worked in services with siblings was by saying to families that I could refer them into a charity, mm-hmm. could offer sibling respite and help, yeah. and support. And but again, it feels so disjointed and it's so separated from where their sibling is, when a lot of the impact is about the relationship that they're, yeah. forming. Because sibling relationships are really important. So rather than nurturing that, I feel like it's pulling people apart and it's not meeting their needs properly, is what I feel.
Well, actually, and the other, I agree. And the other issue is, it's not just like, it's the timeline of this, right? Is, I'm just saying, our own family cases, that this, yes. has been for years and years and years. And I suppose you don't have those, or maybe the family don't know when should I refer the person, what help do they need, what support? And indeed, it's so disjointed.
Yes.
I think it is really, really troublesome. So I think that's a real gap. So that's a great suggestion. So you said you had two. So what's the second one, unrelated then?
Unrelated. So obviously the second one comes from how I work now. Obviously, privately, very different from my NHS role, although I still somehow attract families who have children who have health conditions, which I love because it's kind of like my work, my passion. But I'm really interested in the impact of these little things.
Mobile phones, for those who are listening to this, yeah?
Mobile phones, smartphones, I should say. I'm really interested in the impact of smartphones on adolescent brain development. I feel like, I'm interested in the impact it's having on us as adults, but you know, we've got mature brains, but they don't. And there is something about the quick nature, you know, it's so, so fast. And one of the things that I'm really aware of and have noticed over the past maybe 5-8 years is that teenagers are less and less patient. They want everything fast. And, you know, teenagers are impatient by nature, right? They're impulsive. They are, but there's something about things not being fast enough, not being easy enough, not being like quick enough. And to me, this is a personal kind of professional kind of query. I feel like it's mirroring something that's happening on their phones, which is happening in their pockets every single day. Mm-hmm. Fast, fast. I've got a question, I can answer it. You know, Google. Everything is super fast. I want to talk to my friend, I do it. I want to, whatever.
No delayed gratification.
Yes, instant gratification, exactly. But what is that doing to the brain, which is really slow to mature, especially like certain areas of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex is really slow to mature. And there is a biological reason for that. Like, it's actually good that it's slow to mature because it means it's got more time to practice and mess up and develop all the right wiring. But if actually all it's getting is this quick, 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 then by the time it matures, that's all it wants, is what I think. I don't know. I'm not a neuroscientist.
This is why it's a question, because I get a bit frustrated when I hear in the media the very simple explanation, social media for mental health, when the relationship
is more complex than that.
Much more complicated. But I think that these are questions we absolutely need to address. And because all the research I'm aware of, which has come out looking at that relationship, is it, yes, for people who are already vulnerable, if you look at mental health separately from your comment on sort of that instant gratification and that impatience, the relationship, it is there for some people, and I don't dispute it can be devastating for some people, but those people tend to be vulnerable already. And the effect overall on well-being, if you look at it, obviously the research, published research is relatively modest. But I think we just don't know that with the long term impact, and I think I totally agree. It's a great question to be addressed, and
I think this is the time. I feel like this is an opportunity to look at those kind of questions now, because you can do longitudinal studies.
Yeah, well, there's work going on.
Yes, of course there is. Yeah. These are the first. This is like the first generation of adolescents who are living in this tech embedded world. So. Yeah. this is our time, I feel like. Yeah.
Yeah. And Amy Orban at Cambridge is doing fantastic work on this and others. But she's always my go-to person in that respect with looking at the adolescent mental health, social media, phones relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's pivot slightly and sort of change the topic to your book, right? So it's really exciting that you have your first book out, and it's not out yet. It's out on the 29th of this month.
That's
and
correct.
Of course, a leap year, it's out in a leap year, so that's obviously a good
thing,
a leap day. So it's entitled How to Be the Grown-Up, Why Good Parenting Starts With You. And I love the fact that I've been on your Instagram account, and I see, so for those who haven't visited Marta's account, there's almost 250,000 other people, a quarter of a million followers.
I try not to think about it very much.
Yeah, it must be a bit mind-blowing. But so tell us a bit about what gave you the idea about doing the book. Obviously, you've highlighted to us, your background, and you've 18 years working in the NHS and paediatrics and your family systems approach and all that stuff. So tell us, how did the book come about? What is in the book, and who's it for?
So the book came about, first of all, I guess, from an opportunity. I got asked if I wanted to write a book. And initially I was like, no, are you mad? And then I got asked again and I was like, okay, let me think about it. What is it for? Like, who would it be? Why me? All those things. And so I did it. I think very well supported by my husband, who I need to name here. He won't like it, but there you go. Because I don't think I could have written a book without my husband. So it's a huge endeavor. And he very much was like, you've been given this opportunity, you should do it. And I was like, why? And I don't feel like, this is my anxiety, but I don't feel like I am an expert in parenting, like at all. Like, I really don't. So I was like, why me? And I guess there's something about parenting and parenting books being full of people who talk about parenting but don't have training in child development or brain development or mental health or anything like that. And obviously there are some really good books on child development and parenting who are from like neuroscientists, etc. There aren't that many clinical psychologists who write books on parenting. And I probably wouldn't have written a book on parenting had I not gone on Instagram one day. So the journey is that I went on Instagram after my first maternity leave, just before going back to work in the NHS, because I wanted to get my brain into work mode. And I decided I was going to go part-time into the NHS. So I was like, oh, maybe this would be a nice way of like sharing knowledge and, you know, educational. And then within 2 weeks, lockdown happened.
Hold on. So your timeline, before lockdown, you had zero followers on Instagram.
Oh, yeah, zero. I wasn't on Instagram. I didn't know what Instagram was.
And then between then and now, you've racked up almost a quarter of a million.
Yeah. Oh, I've not been on. Well, I feel like I've been on forever now, but not.
Yeah.
As long, but I think lockdown created something which was about parents seeking out information online. A lot of anxiety about child mental health, adolescent mental health. Yeah. Suddenly I was there going, oh, you know, did you know that children do this or whatever? And suddenly people just started flooding in and people started asking me questions. So one of the things I talk about on my Instagram page is that it's a collaborative page. It's not mine, it's ours. Yeah. I tend to say that a lot. I call it a community, even though some people have a go at me for it. It's not a community, but because it's open, obviously. But to me, it is, because I didn't create this by myself. It happened. It was like a bit of a movement from people, because most of my posts come from questions people have asked. They don't come from my head and something I want to talk about. They come from people saying, can you talk about this? Or I have a question. Mm-hmm. And if I have enough, there's lots of them. I go, okay, this is worth me talking about because everybody's asking the same question. And that's what happened in lockdown. It became about, you know, reducing anxiety about washing hands, how to talk about death, which I used to do at work all the time, talking about death, how to talk to children about physical illness. I was like, oh, this is totally me. How to have a cohesive family unit, how to manage stress at home, all these questions. I was like, oh, I can do this. I can talk about this. Not the expert in it, but I can talk about it. And people like it. And it's from that that, you know, the publisher said to me, would you like to do this? So it was Penguin. And I said, I mean, what on earth? Then I got some lovely support to do it. I've got a really lovely team. So I should say that I have a book agent. I have a team, like managers who support me, speak up for me, do the business stuff that I have no idea what's going on. So they manage all of that. So I feel very lucky that they're there helping me through all this. And then I wrote it, and I wrote it for parents and any adult who is in the presence or relationship with a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it to make child development something that people understand, because I feel like in our society, we misunderstand child development.
Mm-hmm.
And I think adult expectations are placed on children in ways that they can't meet them. Mm-hmm. It's not because they're naughty or they're rude or they're bad kids. It's because developmentally, they're not there yet. And I have this sense, professionally and personally, that if we understood child development better, if it was more like common knowledge, then perhaps what we would do is meet children with greater compassion and understanding. And we would meet ourselves and other parents with the same compassion and understanding. Mm-hmm. Because when we're in public and there's a kid having a tantrum over, you know, my banana's not right, rather than being like, oh, that parent's not got their child in control, we would be like, oh, yeah, that's normal.
Yeah,
that kid's just doing what kids do. And actually, hey, kudos to you, parent. You're doing a really good job. You're doing your best. Like, mm-hmm. that's okay. That's what I would like. Like, I mean, it's a bit of a massive hope, but I would like adults to understand children better. And not just because they're psychologists, but because it's all of us.
No, because just whatever that example you gave just reminded me of one of my horror stories when my kids were young, when I only had one at that stage. My daughter, when she was 18 months, we decided to travel to Australia, which is obviously a good idea.
Wow.
And and so on the plane, there was a delay at Amsterdam, which meant our flights were 12-hour delayed. So we'd planned the long flights to be at nighttime when she would sleep. And of course, with the delay, that didn't happen. But the bit about trying to get other people to understand was, so I'll never forget the day I die, I'm still traumatized by it, is walking, trying to get her to stop crying. And in the middle of the somewhere close to Asia, and trying to walk up and down the aisle to get her to soothe her and whatever. But of course, trying to do it in a way which would be that wouldn't escalate the situation. You could just see so many of the sort of disapproving looks, because he didn't think, a lot of people around didn't, or this is how it felt to me, and we certainly didn't think I was doing enough to keep my child or soothe my child. So I'll never forget that. But part of the anxiety was, because I was thinking other people were thinking this of me. So I think if your book can do something on that, that'd be fantastic. So tell me then a bit about
I hope.
Well, fingers crossed indeed. So in the title, you obviously talk about, obviously, why good parenting starts with you. And I know there's probably not one answer to what good parenting is, and it's probably a bit of an unfair question. But given you've put it in the title of your book, I'm going to ask you, what do you think characterizes good parenting?
For me, good parenting is being able to manage your own triggers, sparks,
mm-hmm.
overwhelming emotions, being able to manage yourself to support a child in learning skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, the other part of good parenting is about accepting that you're going to mess up and you're going to get it wrong. And that's okay. It's human. And the most important thing you need to do is repair the ruptures with your child, like repair the relationship. And I think some people think good parenting means perfect parenting. And I do not. Like, actually, there's research on too perfect parenting being really unhelpful for children and also for our brain development, because brains need things to go wrong. Like, in order to learn resilience, we need to go through hardship. So it's not about plain sailing, everything's perfect, you soothe your child perfectly every time. That's not what it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's supposed to be messy and safe. So for me, it's about how can I, as a parent, hold a really secure, safe relationship with a child. And even if I trip up, remember that it's good enough if I just repair and I, like, you know, heal any any mistake I've done or any harm that I've done. Because I think one of the things in my therapy room that I'm really struck by is how much some parents find it hard to apologize to their children. And what they feel is that it's children's duty to apologize to them. So, for example, your example with the plane, you know, blah, 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 a bit later, some parents might be like, what you did was wrong. Let's say you shouted at your child, right? What you did was wrong. I shouted at you, and I know that's not very nice, but it's because you were screaming in the airport. You know, I'm like, well, that's not an apology. And I actually think as adults, we're really bad at apologizing, like sincerely, genuinely, meaningfully. So that's what I think good parenting is about.
And is that bit then linked to, sorry to jump in there, but linked to then your other bit of your title, which is how to be the grown-up?
Yes.
Part of that is obviously apologizing in a genuine way or whatever.
Yes. And for me, how to be the grown-up is about being aware of the skills you bring to a relationship with a child. Awareness for me is like first step, like with anything like mental health or even in my work, right? When you're aware that there's a problem, then there's a beginning. There's the possibility of change. You know, there's an opportunity for something. If you're not aware, then you're just doing. So what I want to build is awareness and then hopefully allow adults, grown-ups to think, where are my strengths and my skills and where are things that I never learned? And it's not my fault, but it's also not necessarily my parents' fault because I don't believe in blaming like older generations. I believe in learning from older generations. I believe in thinking, I didn't learn that because my parent didn't know that that was something I needed to learn. Mm-hmm. But now I know, what do I have to do to be able to teach this to my child? Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally.
So I think that's what it's about for me, being a grown-up. I mean, it's hard to be a grown-up all the time. I'm going to put it out there. I don't think it's possible. So again, my book is kind of repeatedly talks about doing things imperfectly and messily and getting it wrong because it's normal. It's human. But I think you can do more. You can choose to do more of the good stuff if you're aware of it than if you're just blindly following an old script of what parenting is.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose one of the things that strikes me now is somebody who's sort of come out the other end and that my kids are 15 and 19.
Aww.
When I reflect back to that period, I mean, those early years, they really were tough. So
yes, they are tough.
And when two kids and you two kids now.
I've got two kids with the same age gap as yours. So I love it.
So what age are your kids now though?
I've got a 5-year-old and a 5-month-old.
Ah, yeah. Oh my, you really are in the midst of it all.
Oh yeah. I'm in it.
Publishing a book in the middle of your, I think you said you're still on maternity leave.
Yes, she's only 5 months. I mean, yes, I'm not doing clinical work. I am doing things like this.
Yeah. Which,
she's napping right now, so it's okay.
That is helpful. But then, in the book, do you talk about the impact on parental mental health? Or do you want to comment on, because we know we've talked about postnatal depression and other stuff. So do you want to tell us a bit about that?
I mean, I do talk about it. And I guess it's hard in one book to talk about everything.
Yes.
So I feel like I probably don't do this justice, but I do kind of mention it across chapters about your needs and your mental health being really important. And I also talk about seeking help when needed, because I don't think a book can hold all parents. You know, my book doesn't answer everything. It's not going to help everyone on everything. And I think sometimes it can be useful to know that there are some red flags or some, like, if things persist, that actually you can seek help and you can get support and you don't have to be stuck struggling. And I think around parental mental health, for me, I think it's understanding that it is really hard. It is exhausting. Some of that is normal. But if you can't function in your everyday, if you can't just get basic things done, I often call it like a season of survival, right? But if you're struggling and you're not surviving, and that means that it's affecting your sleep and your food and your ability to socialize, if your anxiety is getting in the way of you leaving the house with baby, for example, if you can't look after yourself, you have no self-care left. Like, it's not a luxury. It should be part of a signal, like a little alarm saying, I'm not okay. It's about seeking support. And I think, first of all, if you can, with those people around you, just saying, help me, I can't do this. is step one. Mm-hmm. But I know some people don't have a circle of support, like it doesn't exist mm-hmm. for them. So then it is about reaching out a little bit wider, like medical professionals, etc. But I kind of, some of the things I talk about in the book is also about reaching in. So if you are a person who knows a new parent, it's really helpful to reach in and be like, are you okay? Do you need some help? How can I practically support you? Because sometimes people won't ask for help, but they could really do with it. I think also mental health with parents, it can look like lots of anger, lots of shouting, like being incapable of tolerating cries because they're so hard when you've got a little baby. And I think if you see yourself getting enraged a lot and that isn't your normal self, because it probably isn't, you need to, again, see that as a little sign that something's not right and your some of your needs are unmet and you need to prioritize that. I think as parents, your mental health comes first. It has to, before you can look after your child.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same in every aspect of life. If we don't look after our own mental health, how can we help anybody else? Okay, we're coming to the end of our time together, Marta. So what are if somebody said to you, what are your three main takeaway messages from your book?
Okay, three main messages. I guess there's a message about child development and mm-hmm. understanding children from the point of view of their brain, social, psychological, physical evolution through childhood that I want people to understand and just hopefully make more common knowledge. I think there's a message about how it does start with us and mm-hmm. what we role model to our children. So if we want children who are generous, polite, you know, kind to others, it starts with us being generous, polite and kind, not just to others, but to our children. And importantly, to ourselves, like model to your child what it's like to be kind to yourself. So rather than saying something negative, oh, I'm such an idiot, being like, oh, you know what? I've had a really exhausting day. So of course I messed up today. By the way, this is really hard. I'm not saying you're going to do this all the time, but if you're able to remember that this is impactful, you might do it a little bit more.
Yeah. Self-kindness is vital and self-compassion, absolutely vital.
Absolutely, absolutely. Rather than shaming yourself, mm-hmm. be compassionate, and that will help your child develop compassion towards others and themselves. It's so key. And a third message, that it's never too late. Mm-hmm. All these things in my book, I offer examples of little ones and adolescents. But, you know, some parents say to me, a bit like you, oh, my kids are all grown up. And I'm like, but it's not too late. I think, to me, all the messages I talk about in my book are adaptable for later years. Yeah, and I like to talk about adult children. Mm-hmm. And it's also never too late to apologize to your kid, no matter how old they are, if you think, I did that thing when they were little and I'm not sure, you know, how did that sit with them? Have a conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, children, adult children, me being one of them, will feel honored that you brought up something to the light, that you're like, oh my God, you were thinking about me. Thank mm-hmm. you for thinking about me, or thank you for honoring the fact that, yeah, that was a really hard time in my life. And it's great that we can talk about it now. We can't change the past. The past is gone, but we can change how we talk about the past and we can change how we move forward with the experiences we've had together. And I think it can grow children closer to their parents, no matter how old they are. So
that's a really optimistic way to end the sort of formal bit of the podcast. So Craig and I were trying to end with two sort of unrelated questions, and usually some version of this. So I'm going to ask you these two quick questions. So, and it's pretty pertinent given that we're talking about developmental aspects here. So what advice would you give your 16-year-old self?
I would say to her, it's okay to be you. I think when I was 16, I was scared of being different to my peers, which is very 16, isn't it? But
it's
okay to be you, like be who you are. And also, I am somebody who has a lot of anxiety. I talk about that, mm-hmm. believe it or not. I hate public speaking. I would say you are much braver than you think.
Mm-hmm. No, great piece of advice.
Yeah.
And then the very last question, and then we'll end it there, is so if you had the opportunity to have a dinner or a coffee with two people, living or dead, famous or not famous, who would they be?
So I would love to have dinner with Professor Brian Cox.
Yeah.
Because I'm fascinated by like the universe, but I'm a psychologist. I love science. I love research. I don't get it. Like, I think it actually bamboozles my brain. Like, I'm like, I don't understand. What are you talking about? Yeah. It literally is like, I can't conceptualize it. Like, it's too big.
I bet you loads of people, because I'd be the same. Sometimes you're watching and they're great programs, but
so great.
Yeah, your head is sort of explodes trying to process it all. Yeah,
absolutely. I'm like, I don't know what this is. But I'd love to have a like. Plus, I think he's fun. Like, he seems to have a great sense of humor and stuff. So I think he would be a fun person to have dinner with. I mean, I'm just going to be a woman on this. I would love to meet Keanu Reeves.
Okay.
He's not the best actor, but he sounds like such a nice man. Mm-hmm. He seems very kind, very generous. I love like his mixed race experience. I'm mixed race too. So I feel like I'd like to know more. Mm-hmm. And he's super handsome. He used to be on my bedroom wall on a poster. So, you know.
That's okay. Well, that with that disclosure, I would challenge you. I think he is a good actor, though. I think he's a good actor.
He did a wonderful, he does Point Break, which is a surf film. And I love surfing. So, you know, there we go.
We'll forgive him that.
It's the okay, Matrix well, for me.
What's the Matrix?
The Matrix. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah. Okay, on that lighthearted note, the very best of luck, Marta, for the release of the book.
Thank you so much.
And so those who are just tuning in at the very end, so the book's entitled How to Be the Grown-Up, Why Good Parenting Starts With You. And I assume it's available in all good bookstores and bookstores and online. And thanks a million and amazing work. And thanks a million for taking the time to join us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
MQ Open Mind is presented by MQ Mental Health Research, the only organisation that exclusively invests into scientific research around mental health. Our vision is to create a world where mental illnesses are understood, effectively treated, and one day prevented. Please leave us a review and let us know what you think about the podcast. Each review helps us reach a wider audience. Visit mqmentalhealth.org to learn more about MQ and mental health research.